We'd like to welcome you all out to this session of SENSO, and the title of this session is Polygamy and Violence. If you haven't already silenced your cell phones, please go ahead and do that. I'm going to have 20 minutes for each speaker, and then please hold your questions until the very end when we're finished with all the speakers. Our speakers today are George Smith, who's a graduate of Stanford University and New York University. He's the editor of the landmark Mormon Pioneer Diary, an intimate chronicle, the journals of William Clayton, and he's also the author of Nauvoo Polygamy, but we called it Celestial Marriage, which received the Best Book Award of 2008 from the John Whitmer Historical Association. This work was updated and revised in 2011. He's published in Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, Free Inquiry, the John Whitmer Historical Journal, Journal of Mormon History, Restoration Studies, and Sunstone. He has served on the boards of the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, the Kenyon Review, the LSB Leakey Foundation, and the National Public Radio. And then we'll also hear from Lindsay Hansen Park, who's the Assistant Director for the Sunstone Educational Foundation and the founder of the Feminist Mormon Housewives podcast, featuring the acclaimed Year of Polygamy series. She's a women's rights activist, a feminist blogger and podcaster, and an advocate against gender violence. She co-founded Utah for Congo to raise awareness for post-rape survivors and is currently heavily involved in the Mormon feminist movement. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, NPR, the Los Angeles Times, and many other Utah publications. She and her family live in Stansbury Park, Utah, where she raises three beautiful kiddos, gardens, and rages against the machine. And Jana Reese holds degrees in religion from Wellesley College and Princeton Theological Seminary, and a PhD in American religious history from Columbia University. She speaks often to media about issues pertaining to religion in America and has been interviewed by the Associated Press, Time, Newsweek, People, the Boston Globe, USA Today, the Los Angeles Times, and Newsday, among other print publications, as well as Voice of America, The Today Show, MSNBC, and NPR's All Things Considered, Tell Me More, and Talk of the Nation. She's the author, co-author, or editor of many books, including Flunking Sainthood, A Year of Breaking the Sabbath, Forgetting to Pray, and Still Loving My Neighbor, What Would Buffy Do, The Vampire Slayer as a Spiritual Guide, Mormonism for Dummies, and The Writer's Market Guide to Getting Published. Her book, The Twible, All the Chapters of the Bible in 140 Characters or Less, now with 68% more humor, won first place in the nonfiction category in the Writer's Digest annual self-published book awards. She blogs for Religion News Service.
Thanks. Okay, so I had a PowerPoint, but it looks like that's not going to work out right now with my laptop. So I'm just going to sort of talk about me and my experience with these essays. As many of you know, I host a podcast that's called the Year of Polygamy series, and it was supposed to just be, like the title said, a year in 2014, and now it's 2015, and people keep saying, I thought that was supposed to be over, but it's not over. We've got a long way to go. It's been a really interesting year for me because I've been able to examine the history in sort of a comprehensive way and take the listeners through it. And admittedly, the past few months have been really, really dark for me because my research is in some of the fundamentalist groups, and that includes the LeBaron group where there's, you know, murders, and the Davis County Co-op where there's allegations of abuse. So it's been a really, really challenging thing for me to do personally, and as my family can attest to, I've been a little grumpy at home. So fast forward to this week, I was trying to think of what I was going to talk about, and as we know, the church all had a press conference on religious freedom and non-discrimination laws. And someone had mentioned that Elder Oaks had made an offhand comment in the questions afterwards with the reporters. It wasn't an official Q&A, but he was allowed to sit and have 3 minutes of conversations with the reporters. And someone said, oh my gosh, Elder Oaks just said that polygamists should be protected under the law. And I read that right before I went to sleep Tuesday night, and I thought, oh, that's weird. You know, I didn't hear his comments. I didn't think anything of it. But Wednesday morning, I woke up completely panicked. Like, I sat out of bed, and my heart was racing, and I have no idea what I was dreaming, I don't know what it was, but I laid back down and I put the covers over me and I just kept repeating to myself, Lindsay, you don't have to live it. You don't have to live it. You don't have to live it. And what's crazy about that is I don't believe it. I don't believe in polygamy, and I haven't for a while, and I think I understand the context. And the rational part of my brain thought, first of all, you haven't even heard what Oakes said. And second of all, even if you did say that, it's just probably a throwaway comment. And the third is, even if the church brought it back, Lindsay, you don't have to live it. Yeah, I was shocked. I mean, I was panicked. I called my friend Sarah. I was crying. I said, I know I'm not being rational, but you need to calm me down. You need to calm me down. And she said, well, what are you so upset about? And I said, well, the first thing is that I have to live it, but I know that I don't. That's just in there somewhere. And the second thing is, if Oakes did say something, it's like the twilight zone to have a church leader publicly, after all these years, talk about polygamy in a legal sense. I mean, it's been a long time. And if you know the history of polygamy, which I've been studying for this last year in a very intense way, it would be very surreal for the church to come out in support of it. So that's what started it off with. My week started off like that. And it really hit home what these essays mean. Because when I read these essays, I read these essays as a Mormon woman. And I tell you that story at the beginning to help you understand how deep-seated the fear and anxiety of polygamy is for Mormon women. Now, I've talked to Mormon women who say that it's not a problem for them, it's not an issue, but every single Mormon woman has to grapple with this at some point or another. And I was unaware of how deeply it affected me till I woke up that morning in a panic, being completely irrational, knowing that I didn't have to live it, but that was my first fear. And it's really made me think that fear and anxiety of polygamy resides in the same place that my faith always has. And those two are always competing for space. And usually with Mormon women, when those two compete, faith wins out, and we say, we'll worry about it later. God will make it okay. But I'm really interested in the way that the essays talk to women, because this is probably one of the most official things the church has said about polygamy in a very long time. And here we have it in record to read. And so I pulled out some quotes from the essays, which you now don't get to have, so I'm just going to talk about them a little bit. I have said publicly that I believe the essays are written by men, and it's very clear in the framing of how they talk about these issues, because they're talking about, when men and women in the church, when Mormon men and women talk about polygamy, we talk about it differently. I don't even know if we realize that we're having different conversations, but we are having different conversations. And I see this even in scholarship. So men will often talk about the number of wives, the practical parts of it, how the marriages happened and things like that. And when you when you read anything like Catherine Danes or Levina Anderson or Jesse Embry, there's all kinds of great scholarship out there. It's a little bit different. The approach and the angle is different. And I saw that pretty starkly in the essays. I'm going to give you some examples of the ways that I think the essays address men instead of women. And that doesn't mean men can't be concerned about it. I just think it doesn't take into account how a woman might be reading these topics. So one of the things they said in the essay, quote, many details about the early practice of plural marriage are unknown. Plural marriage was introduced among the early saints incrementally, and participants were asked to keep their actions confidential. They did not discuss their experiences publicly or in writing until after the Latter-day Saints had moved to Utah and the church leaders had publicly acknowledged the practice. The historical record of early plural marriage is therefore thin. A few records of the time provide details, and here's the money quote, and later reminiscences are not always reliable. Okay? I want you to think on that. Later reminiscences aren't always reliable. They go on to say the revelation on plural marriage was not written down until 1843. And then they go on to say how reliable that is, even though it was written down years later after that. So when I read this, I think about the discussions I have had with Mormon scholars or polygamy deniers. And they will always say, a lot of the evidence we have of Joseph Smith's polygamy come from his wives and the affidavits from the Temple Lot case. And those were years and years and years later, after the church was already in Utah. So we can't really trust those, right? And I saw the essay give a nod to that, that later reminiscences aren't always reliable. Now, they didn't say that specifically, but I do believe it is a nod to those scholars that are saying, well, you know, they might have said that they had sexual relations with Joseph on the stand, but that was a long time later, so we can't trust it. However, in the next paragraph, they say, even though Joseph wrote down the revelation, you know, 13 years, 12 years after the fact, that's reliable, but these women's testimonies, sworn testimonies and affidavits, we don't know. And this is a problem with how we talk about Joseph Smith. It drives me crazy, actually, especially polygamy deniers, because what it does is it privileges the reputation of one man over the reputation of many women. And who has more to lose in Victorian frontier America, right? The women. And so it's just fascinating to me that we still do this. And when I say protect the reputation of Joseph Smith, Mormons are so funny when it comes to sex that we can't even say that Joseph would have sex with his wives. We're like, no, 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 no. He married them, but there was no sex. I mean, that's weird, right? That's weird. So polygamy is weird, but that's weirder. And so to save Joseph from that, we have to throw these women who got up on the stand and testified publicly about their sex lives in the 19th century. Think about that for a minute and say, oh, I don't know about that. But Joseph can write a revelation down years and years later, and that's good. So that's one of the problems, the inequities that I see with the way that we talk about plural marriage. Another quote that I saw was that they talk about Fanny Alger in this essay, which I think is fantastic. I think this essay has so many good things about it. But they say, fragmentary evidence suggests that Joseph Smith acted on the angel's first command by marrying a plural wife. Fanny Alger in Kirtland, Ohio, in the mid-1830s. Several Latter-day Saints who had lived in Kirtland reported decades later that Joseph Smith had married Alger, who had lived and worked in the Smith household. Here's the money part. After he had obtained her consent and that of her parents. Okay? And I read that as a feminist woman. I'm like, yay, anytime we talk about consent, that's fantastic. They're showing this. Joseph got her consent and the consent of her parents. And then they move on, and they say, little is known about this marriage, and nothing is known about the conversations between Joseph and Anna regarding Alger, which is a little bit misleading. We don't know nothing. We have some things. We have lots of things that talk about that. But later on, when they're talking about consent, they talk about Joseph and Emma. And what I think is interesting is this quote right here. I think this is the right quote. The revelation on marriage required that a wife give her consent before her husband could enter into plural marriage. Nevertheless, toward the end of the revelation, the Lord said that if the first wife received not this law, the command to practice plural marriage, the husband would be exempt from the law of Sarah. Presumably, the requirement that the husband gain the consent of the first wife before marrying additional women. After Emma opposed plural marriage, Joseph was placed in an agonizing dilemma, forced to choose between the will of God and the will of his beloved Emma. See how they throw God under the bus there? Sorry, God, it's really tough. He may have thought Emma's rejection of plural marriage exempted him from the law of Sarah. Her decision to receive not this law permitted him to marry additional wives without her consent. Okay, so this stood out to me. Because fundamentalists that I've been studying, law of Sarah, depending on which group, is an important thing. It's this idea that you have to ask your wife before you take on additional wives. She says no. Too bad, you get to do it anyway, but at least you asked. Okay? That's basically, I mean, that's reductive, but that's basically the law of Sarah. So they're using this here. Okay? They're using this here and saying, well, he tried, he asked, and she did give her consent, and she went back and forth, and she said no, and so maybe that's why he married the other women. I don't know how that accounts for Fanny Alger. Was Emma asked in 1831? Was she asked in 1832? Was she asked, you know, in the early 1830s, hey, I'm looking to marry Fanny Alger? I can't find any evidence. The essay doesn't point to any evidence. And this is what I'm talking about. The essay is completely framed without considering what a woman like me might be reading and thinking, if I'm in this situation, does my consent matter? Because what I'm reading in Emma's consent is it doesn't matter. So why are we using the word consent if it means nothing, right? So that was one of the ways that I read it. I have so many examples. For example, in the other essay about plural families in Utah, they talk about marriage and the reasons for marriage, and they give some of the old excuses, like, this is my favorite part, they're like, it brought more children into families, and then there's a footnote, and then you click the footnote, and it says, well, actually, monogamous marriages had more children than plural marriage. So great, the footnotes on the Utah essay are great. But one of the things that they say in the Utah essay is they say, marriage became available to virtually all who desired it. Now, this could just be my interpretation, but as a Mormon, when I hear that, I'm like, oh, cool. You know, single moms and widows and women that are too ugly to get married and women that no one wants to marry. Now everybody can get married, right? That's what I'm thinking as a Mormon. That's what I think that this line is pointing to. The problem with that is these writers of this essay fail to see how problematic that is. They write this as like, hey, see, this is why. Doesn't it all make sense? If you are a single mom, if you are a single woman, if you're someone who's not married, what makes you think that half a husband is going to be better than being single, right? And people say, well, oh, you know, back then they couldn't own property and things like that. So what we've done is relegate women to property, to being split up, to be owned by a man. And it introduces a whole slew of other problems into the scenario than being a single mom in front of your Utah Neverwood, right? Some are good, some are not so good. And by just saying that marriage becomes available, yay, everybody wins, completely reduces all of the problems. And there were many, 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 many problems with this. And as we know, after the manifesto, it breaks up these families. I mean, my husband's family, his great-grandmother was a third wife. She was kicked off of her property. She had to go work in hotels. She had to make ends meet, and she was eventually committed to a mental institution. So what I'm saying is it's not clear-cut. I don't expect the essays to be clear-cut. They have to be very concise, but it is very clear to me, and I could give you more and more and more and more examples. These essays are written through a male lens. They are written through concerns that men think about when they think about polygamy, which is fine. That's important. But the women who disproportionately have to be affected by this, it doesn't even account for that at all. And I don't really have a solution. In studying fundamentalism, I realize now that everyone talks about the church being deceitful, like they've hidden this stuff, right? And we know this stuff has been out there, but a lot of people feel betrayed. And to be fair, there have been some attempts to keep this stuff under wraps. But now I know it's not because the church is worried that good members of the church are going to leave the church. They're doing it because they're worried good members of the church are going to leave the church and join a fundamentalist group. Because, as Sanjeev Bhattacharya, who I interviewed for my podcast, said, Mormon doctrine is strong potion. There's something strong. It's like this strong tonic. Mormon fundamentals, Mormon theology, taken to their logical conclusions, can lead in some really interesting ways. And we see this played out with our fundamentalist brothers and sisters, right? We see blood atonement taken off to some really scary ways. We see polygamy taken off to some interesting and sometimes dangerous ways. Their Mormon doctrine is strong stuff. LDS doctrine has kind of watered it down, and I think it's to protect us from it. But people do. I think Brian Hales quoted in 1998 that six Mormon families were leaving the church a month and joining the AUB. And after the temple and priesthood ban, the AUB's converts doubled and their polygamous marriages tripled. So Mormonism is strong stuff. It doesn't leave. And so I believe that the church is in a bind, because if they are more honest about this kind of stuff, it could lead people down paths that they don't want to go. And I could point out 100 different phrases in these essays that could point people towards fundamentalism too. It's a really, really tricky balance. So I don't really have an answer. I do want to acknowledge the work that they've done. to bringing this to light. There are a lot of good things. They do acknowledge some of the women's narratives. They do acknowledge the pain that it caused. I don't think Emma got a fair treatment of this subject at all. That is a shame. But it's a step in the right direction. The only solution I have that would fix both these problems for fundamentalists and Mormon women is to repudiate and say that it was a mistake, but I don't think that's going to happen. So, thank you.
I'm loving the irony that we're talking about polygamy and the panelists are three women and one man. I'm not an expert on polygamy, unlike both George and Lindsay. So my comments are a little more personal, and I hope you'll bear with me on that. I'm going to open with a fairly long story. I promise it will be relevant. Sarah Agnes Turk was only 15 years old when a young man sought her hand in marriage. When Isaiah Moses Coombs first met Sarah in 1844, he was 10 and she was 5. Isaiah considered Sarah his angel, fair and lovely. They were wed a decade later in November of 1854 in southern Illinois. Within just a few months of their marriage, however, Isaiah was eager to reunite with his Mormon people in Utah, and Sarah, who was not a Mormon, was adamant that she would not go. The sticking point, as he recounted near the end of his life in his autobiography, was that Sarah would not countenance, quote, the principles of Mormonism, unquote. One can only assume that included polygamy, often referred to during this period as the principle. So Isaiah crossed the plains without her in the summer of 1855. In 1856, he was traveling back through Illinois on a mission with Parley P. Pratt, and so he stopped in and tried to reconcile with Sarah, who had in the intervening time given birth to and soon buried their infant son. Sarah was still adamant she was not going to Utah. Grieving, Isaiah left her behind in the Midwest, but he rallied when he returned to Utah, serving as a school teacher and then for 17 years as the tithing clerk to Brigham Young. Isaiah married two more wives and fathered 20 more children. One of his youngest daughters, born in 1879, he named Sarah Agnes Coombs, presumably demonstrating that even two decades after his failed first marriage, he still thought fondly of his childhood sweetheart. It's unlikely that they kept in touch or that he knew that she also eventually remarried and had 7 children. It is through that second husband, George Albert Reese, that Sarah Agnes Turk Coombs became my great-great-grandmother. I stumbled across this story a few years ago when researching my father's family history after his death, and I was stunned. We have no Mormons whatsoever in my family history. In fact, Sarah's second husband was the son of a circuit-riding, God-fearing German-American Protestant pastor who helped to found several churches in St. Louis, and one seminary, Eden Theological Seminary, which is still in existence today. There is no account of Sarah's first teenage marriage in all of the records of my family, perhaps suggesting the stigma that was attached to an abandoned marriage in the 19th century, compounded with the additional stigma that the first husband in question was a Mormon to boot. I don't even know if her second husband, my great-great-grandfather, ever learned the truth of what a Google search revealed to me. Finding this story was a wonderful surprise for me, not just because it was interesting and unexpected, but because it helped me connect with something visceral. I have long harbored a very real aversion to polygamy, like you. The church's history of polygamy raises for me many uncomfortable questions about the complicated ways that Mormonism has regarded women. I am uneasy that church leaders lied so repeatedly about plural marriage to the government that persecuted them, and in the case of Joseph Smith, at least, to his first wife, Emma. However, in my dissertation research, I'd also seen another side to plural marriage, that it could contribute, in a somewhat ironic manner, to women's independence and strength. Some of these wives built a feminist case for plural marriage, and I feel I would be doing them a further injustice not to at least try to take them at their word. So I've been hard-pressed to explain why my personal aversion to polygamy was so strong. until I found out about my great-great-grandmother. I think perhaps there really is something to blood ties. I've been thinking about Sarah a fair amount the last few months since the church released its statement on plural marriage in Kirtland and Nauvoo. History will out. As many have already commented, it is both vindicating and sad that this document is built upon strong independent research that the church spent considerable energies in the recent past trying to downplay. I don't see a grand conspiracy in this. We are a church that's run by businessmen, emphasis on the men part, and not by historians. More's the pity, right? Their emphasis is on shepherding an institution into a healthy future, not necessarily on better understanding the tumultuous past. So it's not surprising that sometimes they have made errors about the importance polygamy once played in our history, like when President Hinckley stated in an interview on Larry King Live that, quote, only between 2% and 5% of our people were involved in, unquote, polygamy. I greatly appreciate the fact that the first gospel topic statement on polygamy, released in late 2012, addressed that issue head on, quote, probably half of those living in Utah Territory in 1857 experienced life in a polygamous family as a husband, wife, or child at some point during their lives. By 1870, 25 to 30% of the population lived in polygamous households, and it appears that the percentage continued to decrease over the next 20 years. Thank you. Why was that so hard? If I'm forgiving of individual members and leaders who have perpetuated myths about polygamy, like saying that it solved the problem, that we're not enough women for all the men, when actually it helped to create that problem, I'm a lot less sympathetic to the ways that plural marriage was systematically erased from most of the religious curriculum of the church. The term desaparecida comes to mind. I was a Relief Society teacher back in 1998 when the new Brigham Young curriculum was introduced. In the manual, polygamy, which had been such an enormous feature of Brigham Young's life and theological teaching, was nowhere mentioned. Even the brief chronology of his life at the back of the book made it seem that Young had been a typical Victorian monogamist, losing his first wife to illness in 1832 and then remarrying in 1834, just the one time. I had to figure out a way to teach historical truth using a manual that seemed to encourage me to ignore important facts about Young's life and beliefs. Not only had he married some 55 times, but he also taught that celestial marriage, then defined as plural marriage, was necessary for eternal exaltation. So I'm grateful for the two gospel topic statements that we've had about plural marriage. Actually, there are three more. All three are done. I found them so far to be well-researched, well-written, and for the most part surprisingly candid. There are some false notes, like saying that plural wife Helen Mar Kimball was sealed, quote, several months before her 15th birthday, unquote, because we are too terrified to admit in this Google keyword world that she was only 14 years old when she was married to a man 2 decades her senior. Where the church made me mad, actually, was in acting surprised by all the surprise. In the days that followed the release of the revelations about Joseph Smith having as many as 40 wives, some of whom were teenagers and some of whom had been married to other men, the public affairs department was likely swamped with calls and inquiries, so it issued a press release titled Church Provides Context for Recent Media Coverage on Gospel Topics Statements. Let me read just a little bit of that press release. Much of what you'll find in the essays on polygamy has been published in diverse sources and known among long-term and well-read members, historians, and church leaders for many years. The church has now gathered this information into a single location as a convenient means of placing these resources into the hands of all members. The fact that Joseph Smith had plural marriage relationships is not new, of course. Indeed, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints publicly asserted Joseph Smith's practice of polygamy over a century and a half ago, especially in debate with other faith groups who traced their origin to Joseph Smith and who asserted that he did not practice plural marriage. Well, so that's all cleared up, of course. I'm wondering, though, exactly how people were supposed to come by this knowledge about the somewhat sordid-sounding details of plural marriage in practice. The statement makes it sound like this kind of knowledge was just out there for the taking, discussed at church with some regularity, but it wasn't at all. As I've said, it wasn't in the manuals. If you wanted to find out about that, you certainly could. Maybe. With close to 60% of the membership of the church now living outside the United States and a full 90% outside of Utah, it is naive to assume that everyone will have somehow just picked all this up by osmosis. If you grew up Mormon in the United States, you speak English as a first language, and you had polygamous family stories to teach you about history that had been banished from the official curriculum, congratulations. You are now a privileged minority. Tom, this is for you. As a convert, I certainly did not grow up hearing stories about polygamy at a grandparent's knee, but as a reader, I learned about it later, in books that were printed only in English, not Spanish, or Portuguese, or Korean. Where do we go from here with our conversations about polygamy? One thing that I hope the church will address is the thorny theological question of whether plural marriage remains the order of heaven, a question that continues to plague some Mormon women I know. This is the elephant in the room. And it's not just left-of-center Mormons who need clarification. My great-great-grandmother Sarah was not the only one with a revulsion to polygamy. I am not the only one with a revulsion, and neither are you. In fact, social science research presented recently in the book Seeking the Promised Land offers a fascinating statistic on just how widespread this is. When asked whether they felt a particular issue was immoral, morally acceptable, or not a moral issue, here's a breakdown of how many Mormons declared that certain activities were, quote, morally wrong, unquote. Drinking alcohol. 54% of Mormons surveyed said that drinking alcohol was morally wrong. Having an abortion, 74%. Sex between unmarried adults, 79%. Practicing polygamy, 86% said it was morally wrong. Not just, it's not what I want for my family, but if other people want to do it, then that's okay. No, morally wrong. Of the remaining people surveyed, 11% said polygamy was not a moral issue, and only 2% of Mormons said it was morally acceptable. It seems that Mormons hate polygamy even more than abortion. I've never heard a Mormon say that abortion is an ideal practice, that we're not living now, but we will someday be living in heaven. The very thought is preposterous, and that is a strange disconnect, because despite contemporary Mormons' even greater aversion to polygamy, we do sometimes hear it extolled as the order of heaven, as explained in Doctrine and Covenants 132. How many Mormons confess to hating polygamy, yet imagine themselves practicing it for all of eternity? How many believe, on the one hand, in a loving God who desires their eternal happiness, and on the other, that this same God would make them live in a manner they consider morally wrong? So theology is where I hope our conversations will turn in the future, now that we've established some of the basic historical facts about plural marriage. I hope that the gospel topic statements have set a precedent for where these conversations should be occurring at church. Thanks.
Those two presentations were really quite inspirational to me, but my concern is not polygamy, but polyandry, my worst fear. Can you imagine, guys? turning the thing around, what a terribly uncertain situation that would put men in. And when you were speaking, that sort of flash of unreality came over me, and I stopped to think for a minute. It's kind of a long time coming, but it was just recently that Mormon polygamy came back to life, if we can call that, in October 2014. These essays, widely broadcast in last October, shook the Mormon community with a shocking admission of Joseph Smith's extramarital behavior. That is, beyond his first marriage. On October 22nd, a very key date, of course, and you know it, 2014, the headline in the Salt Lake Tribune read New Mormon Essay, Joseph Smith Married Teens, Other Men's Wives. Mormon leaders have acknowledged for the first time 14-year-olds. This is really extraordinary to see in the headlines. And interestingly enough, Peggy Fletcher, whose name was under the Salt Lake Tribune article, is not available for comment. I don't know if anybody's talked to Peggy, but she really has not been excited to explain just what happened. And I've heard various stories that she really didn't write the headline and maybe would not have been happy as with something else. But it's, I think the next person to speak here or somewhere would be Peggy Fletcher. And what was the process of communicating that essay to her, finding it, communicating it? How did she end up writing the article on the front page of the Tribune? Who wrote the headline? And then why had she disappeared suddenly after? There's sort of an after story there, which I really don't know too much about. And maybe I got it a little bit wrong. Well, that was October 22nd. Then November the 11th, Laurie Goodstein wrote an article in the New York Times about Mormon leaders having acknowledged for the first time a 14-year-old. And she quotes Richard Bushman, who indicated that somewhere along the line, they decided they were just going to tell the whole story. And there's no single fact that's more unsettling than Joseph Smith's marriage to other men's wives. A little later, November 30th, the New York Times publishes an elaboration by Timothy Egan, who occasionally writes op-eds for the Times. And he writes, "One of his brides was a 14-year-old girl, or as church officials put it, several months before her 15th birthday." So well put it. Well, that changes everything. He adds, "Joseph Smith was a man of God, no doubt, but he was also a man with considerable appetites. In his defense, he came to his decision only under duress," the church explained. "A sword-wielding angel forced him to take on a life of sanctioned promiscuity." Now, that's a term that I can resonate with. "Mary Elizabeth Rollins was 12 years old when Joseph told her God had commanded him to take her as a plural wife." And here we cite, as he did, Linda King Newell in Mormon Enigma, one of the very good books on the subject. She later married him at 23, wife number 9. "How is Smith's behavior, some Mormons have asked, any different from that of the crazed religious zealot who kidnapped the 14-year-old Elizabeth Smart in 2002 and forced her to have sex with him? Both men said they were commanded by God." Well, the issue of plural marriage, as most of us are somewhat familiar with, goes back to 1830 in the publication of the Book of Mormon. And the essence of that message was polygamy, yes, but not yet. And there's something ambiguous. It's there, it's forbidden, but if I tell a prophet somewhere, then it will come back. So how does that work? It just sort of faded away. And during the 1830s, while this message was fading, Joseph was meeting future plural wives, some of them quite young, some in their preteen years. And in 10 years, they would be teenagers. And some were teenagers, and in 10 years, they'd be in their 20s. and some were a little older. But the meetings, most of his wives he met during the 1830s. The 1840s was the significant beginning of Mormon polygamy. Fanny Alger, is she a wife? Is she not a wife? What happened between the haymo and the altar? And it's ambiguous, and people take sides on that. I certainly don't know the answers, but it was in 1840 that Joseph Smith discussed the issue with Joseph Bates Noble, a close follower and friend of Joseph. And he arranged for Noble to marry him to his first Nauvoo wife the following spring in 1841. During that time, the apostles, most of them were away on missions in Europe. Joseph's father had just died, sort of changing the family dynamics, if you will. John Bennett, kind of a loose cannon in certain ways, moved into the Mormon community, took over as mayor of the town, was offered a revelation in the Doctrine and Covenants, and probably had a number of plural wives with Joseph, but he was expelled from the community, and all of the records regarding to Bennett are really not there. So 1841, we have three marriages of Joseph Smith. The apostles begin to return from England, and as Brigham Young says, well, I just got back and I wanted to reconnect with my wife and several children, and Joseph asked me to take a plural wife. This was very hard for Brigham, and he talked about wanting the grave, and he was very, very unhappy. That was the first of Joseph's inner circle of 32 men. These 32 men married wives from 1842 to 1844 during Joseph's lifetime, and then other men became polygamous, but this was his inner circle. So Joseph plus the inner circle of 32, and again, we don't really know about Bennett. There's some Bennett's involved somehow. In 1844, the house fell down, basically. It became more and more obvious. There were marriages, and one of Joseph's new wives, and I'm sorry I don't have the name in front of me, but on the way back from the marriage, she recalls, it was funny, we just got married and we had to go back to town by different pathways. Is that a strange way to have a wedding? So there's marriage and then there's secrecy, and what is the secrecy about? And Emma and her children, Joseph's children, were not at most of these weddings. So things were a little unusual, but the numbers of weddings, not just Joseph marrying the 38 to 40 women, but the number of other people of those 32 who ended up marrying an average of 9 to 10 wives apiece. So that was a very productive inner circle, and it formed essentially the footprint of continuing plural marriage in Nauvoo and in, of course, in Salt Lake after the migration. So we have this terrible event in 1844. There is a reformist movement in Nauvoo. They said, we don't like plural marriage. It's got to stop. There's a press which publishes the stories of some of these marriages. Joseph, as mayor of the town, has the press destroyed. The state of Illinois arrests Joseph and his brother. They are shot to death in jail. Militias are forming in the towns around Nauvoo, and things are getting very serious. Governor Ford says to Brigham Young, who inherited the responsibilities, I can't protect you. There's going to be civil war, and this is really getting serious. So, and he advises Brigham Young to head out west into what was then Mexican territory and form your community free of U.S. Customs and restrictions, which Brigham Young, of course, did, crossing the Mississippi River and sending Sam Brannan from New York around Cape Horn, South America, in a ship, Ship Brooklyn. So the Mormons moved in 1846, essentially escape from Nauvoo turmoil, all related to plural marriage, which was connected with Joseph Smith's death. So it was a very difficult time. And as a result, plural marriage was not announced for years later. This was in 1852. There was an informal announcement the year before, but it was 1852 when it was announced. And from 1865 to 1915, after all this secrecy, they felt like there was a necessity to record this wonderful, unusual history, and they collected 75 affidavits concerning Nauvoo polygamy over that period of time, 1869 to 1915. So just as the memory is being reconstructed and solidified, the forgetting begins. The federal government puts pressure on the Mormons. The manifesto is agreed upon, ending Mormon polygamy. Church President Wilford Woodruff comes to San Francisco, has a meeting with U.S. Senator Leland Stanford in San Francisco, agreeing to end the practice. He goes back to Utah, presents a manifesto to the fall conference in Salt Lake City. It's approved unanimously, and polygamy ostensibly ends, although it is by degrees over a number of years. But there's a motive now to forget this painful struggle. Mormons and U.S. government, the fundamentalists are practicing in spite of this. So there's the sense, well, let's help the government end the polygamy. So there's this division. Now you have Mormons not only forgetting polygamy, but opposed to the polygamy that's going on around in the 20th century. And now we have cross forces. You have a process of forgetting, and not long after, in the 1930s, you start to have a process of remembering. Stanley Ivins is starting to write. Dale Morgan at the Bancroft Library in Berkeley, and Fawn McKay Brody, niece of President David O. McKay, got together, exchanged letters, and then Fawn published her book in 1945, the first really major document in the remembering of Nauvoo polygamy, re-remembering. The affidavits are back there. The book, with some errors, are published in 45 and another edition in 71. And then you have people, other people writing, Michael Quinn, Todd Compton. There are lists of people writing books about the subject. So from this period of 1945 to 2014 is this wave of remembering that which had been forgotten. And as that remembering discovers all these lesson books that have these prophets with one wife, you know, there's this conflict. And the church is taking a proactive, a very important posture in addressing the conflicts. Frankly, I think the current church historian and the last one before are very brave and very strong and probably have some support to do this, quite obviously. But it's certainly not easy. And I think our role as people interested in history and accuracy should be very supportive and complementary to the essays for, going this far. It's very, very difficult. So that's what leads up to the Salt Lake Tribune headline, Joseph Smith Married Teens, Other Men's Wives. It's a phase of remembering which is now coming in and washing out the forgetting phase. And I think the forgetting is about over, but the readjustment is rather seismic in its proportions. A lot of people had a lot of difficulty in now going back to the remembering part. So that's kind of the update as of this moment where we are on the issue of polygamy. Thank you.
Okay, we've got time for questions, and you can just ask your questions from where you are. So, go ahead.
You know, one thing that interests me about the topics overall is that they each frame themselves with some sort of faith statement. You know, like, put the faith in the scriptures, you know, Joseph had vision and told everybody about it. I mean, they had those at the beginning and end. And I found it really quite surprising myself that the plural marriage of Joseph begins with monogamy is the law of the church, right? And that, or it doesn't quite say that, but it's some statement like that. And to do that, it references the Book of Mormon, which is mostly anti-polygamy, but is also 1829. And, you know, clearly, plural marriage is Joseph's kind of final word on the subject. And I'm just curious if anybody else was struck by that and just kind of what the discourse in the church is about that. Would that, because it has to get really wishy-washy at the end to say, well, there are a few plural marriages, and yeah, men can now move second and third wives, and this is going to be a problem in the afterlife, but it's sort of like it's an exception and God will work it out. And I just found that actually remarkable. And I'm just curious how that fits into overall, and if any of you have comments on that and how it just fits into overall discourse in the church.
Sorry, I'm so short. I can't see any of you. Hello. So I've thought about this, and I actually talked about this on a Mormon Stories podcast, because the essays each open with a statement like that, but I believe, and I don't have it in front of me, but I think it's the Utah statement that words it a little bit differently that I actually found hopeful. It said, and at certain times, the standard of marriage is between a man and a woman unless the Lord declares otherwise, period. And I was like, hey, loophole. Because I see that if that's the language we can continue to use, that if the Lord declares that marriage can be between a man and a woman sometimes, then that gives us a loophole. I do think that it was, you know, a way to sort of reaffirm that the church is all about. I mean, it was this religious freedom agenda that we're seeing. But I was hopeful in that wording. I mean, I think, personally, I think it's completely hypocritical of the church to try to divine traditional marriage. I mean, that's just not our jam. We're not good at it. We have an institutional history of being really bad at it. So that's my answer.
I don't know that this is directly in relation to your question, but thinking about how God is presented in these essays, in the polygamy essay, at least I get the sense that we are more willing to throw God under the bus than we are willing to throw Joseph Smith under the bus. And to say that even from the beginning this was commanded by an angel of God under threat of serious violence, you know, that God would be willing to resort to serious violence to make Joseph Smith do what Joseph Smith wanted to do anyway. So, a little editorializing there. But thinking seriously and theologically about how we position God here, I think is important.
Well, I'm not sure how relevant this is to either the question or the answers, but maybe we should look at it from Joseph Smith's point of view. How did it feel to be on the haymow and have your wife opening the door and looking at you? Wouldn't that be rather disturbing? I mean, he had a lot to deal with.
So I have to confess, I haven't been following any of this stuff, the stories and all that. Well, yeah, I have some friends in Utah tell me about that stuff. But one thing that's interesting me, or it's interesting me, is I can hardly turn on the television where it was in a biopic or some type of series about polygamy. And most of it takes place in Utah. I remember reading Krakauer's book a few years back. Any feelings about the interest about Mormon polygamy? I mean, this is huge. It's a huge cultural phenomenon. I think it's even more important than what's happening within the Mormon Church in terms of impact on U.S. culture.
Okay, well, I'll start with that. This is interesting as well. This is, in the series, I am, you know, starting out with Joseph Smith's polygamy, and then throughout our podcast, we're moving to contemporary. So right now, we're in the fundamentalist period, and I'm learning so much. But one of the things I'm learning the most is how closely related Mormonism is to fundamentalism. Like, we like to think, like, at least I grew up in Utah being told, oh, that these guys are wicked, they've taken things too far, that's not us, they, you know, they're so messed up. This is where we get the polygamy is a moral thing, you know, 82% or whatever. That's how I grew up. And when I started studying fundamentalism, I was like, oh my gosh, we are them, they are us.
In terms of belief, practice?
In terms of so many things. So we have so many different crossover beliefs. I'll just give you an example. For example, the Kingston group, they drink a green drink that is supposed to ward off, like they give it to their kids, and it's supposed to ward off the nuclear holocaust when the earth is burned by fire, right? If you're a Mormon, you've heard some version of that, right? So there's like these weird crossovers, and then there's things that we absolutely do the same, like AUBs, a lot of their buildings look very similar to LDS, and a lot of them... The Apostolic United Brethren group. There is a break-off sect. A lot of these fundamentalists go on LDS missions. They get married in the temple. It just depends on the group. I mean, it's all different. We're very, very, very similar. In fact, we are more similar. We look more... LDS looks more like, say, the FLDS than it does the Community of Christ or the RLDS. Any polygamy group, any group that took polygamy looks very similar to those who didn't, if that makes any sense. And so this is kind of a long answer to your question. So when we hear about polygamy in the news, I think it's important to remember that Mormon polygamy has always been in the news. Like, it's always been on a headline. It's always been, there have always been exposés written, you know. I just think the LDS Church was trying to say, to finally breathe and say, oh yeah, those exposés, that's not us. That's not us. But really, I mean, it is. We are so connected to each other, and I think that that's kind of one of the myths that we tell ourselves and we tell other people. We're very connected. In fact, I was talking to a man from the AUB, the Apostolic United Brethren, and I was telling him this. I was like, yeah, we're so similar. He's like, no, we're not. We're so different. And I said, wait a minute, that's not your line. That's our line. We're the ones that get to say that we're different. And so it's interesting to see how everyone tries to separate themselves, but theologically, this is why people jump from group to group to group. Mormons will convert to, you know, FLDS, then to Centennial Park, and then come back to LDS. People are always group hopping. This is quite common. So that's my answer to it. Polygamy is always interesting to people, Mormon polygamy especially, and I don't think we're getting away from it.
I just want to take a quick straw poll. How many people have watched or do watch regularly Sister Wives? Here? Raise it proud, people. Fly that flag. Okay, me too.
Oh,
I can do that.
I'm a big love kind of guy. So.
Yeah, big love. Okay, yeah. Big love. Let's take a straw poll. Yeah. So, what is it that is enduring? I'm particularly interested in as someone who studies pop culture, why non-Mormons are so fascinated by polygamous unions. What's, in terms of your question, what's powerful for me is the relationships between the women or among the women. And I think that that is probably resonating with a lot of people, of other people as well. It is interesting that in terms of the sister wives, they were very explicit about doing this show and putting their lives publicly in order to normalize their lifestyle, so that they could become protected under the law. And so far, their strategy is working.
I can't speak from personal experience in my own family, but my wife's family comes from a polygamous background, and there were two houses in Mexico, Colonia Juarez, up in the mountains, These were Swiss-German-looking houses, even though they were in Mexico. And grandpa had two wives and were sisters and equal number of children, like, I don't know, 8 or 10 children.
Nine
children in one house, nine in another. And then there were questions, how come grandpa goes out of this house and spends time in that house? And as the kids got older, we heard from cousins about a lot of jealousy, a lot of, what is he doing there? That's not his wife, and that's Aunt Emma, or something like that. So there was a lot of residual anxiety that as these kids got older, they wanted to go back and unearth all these relationships and figure out what happened. And but it was very fair. It was sort of a balance. 1 week here, 1 week there. Everybody was cared for. They had food. They were eventually thrown out of Mexico in the Third Manifesto and lived in Arizona. And at that point, it's sort of ambiguous because polygamy was outlawed. And did they stay married or not? I guess they...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, they stayed married, but...
They lived together in Arizona.
Could you just... Where in Arizona? How close?
So in Tucson area, actually, Pima, Arizona. And I think they were the only polygamous family in the community. But my grandfather lived with his two wives.
This incidentally is the same family as George Romney's family. They came back around the same time and were... I'm trying to get Camilla's sister to invite Romney to come over, and she's hesitant, you know, so he's so important and we're not. But I think that would be kind of interesting, and we may have a real close look at this if there is if Romney does run and the subject comes to the fore, maybe in connection with the essays and the revitalization of Mormon interest in polygamy. That might be an avenue to bring further light on the subject.
Thank you.
In the essay, and even in the discussion today, we talk about polygamy as a binary, like people are married or they're not. But that's not how things work. We've had a lot of men around pitching woo and courting. I'm wondering what... We don't talk about that aspect of destabilizing society, that the men were unconstrained. I wonder if the panel might address that a little bit. Like, how did that, or how could that possibly impact the practice of polygamy?
Are you talking about then or now, or both?
Well, then, I guess, but now. I mean, are men still unconstrained in pitching woo today? I thought we were hitting ourselves now.
I am unfamiliar with the term pitching woo. I think we call it macking now, so just saying. That was an old term, too. That was... Okay, so...
Where were you guys born? Courting. They're
courting.
Courting. They can go out and
flirt. So courting was interesting because in Nauvoo it was secretive, right? You didn't court openly in Nauvoo. And then after, you know, 1852, when it was announced, you did court openly, but this, I mean, there's fascinating stuff, and of course I would recommend everyone listen to my podcast because we talk about this, but there's these great stories about the soldiers coming in to do surveys, right? The soldiers are coming in, and these Mormon women are falling in love with these young men, even though they've just been married off during the Mormon Reformation to older gentlemen. And they're finding guys their own age, and even Brigham Young's daughter-in-law, his Brigham Young Jr.'s, I think it's his second wife, she falls in love with the soldier, and he hatches a plan to like rescue her from the clutches of Brigham Young's son, and it becomes this big scandal, and Brigham Young puts a hit out on him. It's this crazy, crazy, fascinating story. But this is happening, and so... One of the women was Heber Kimball's wife, and she ran away with the soldiers. So we see the rhetoric start to change. Heber C. Kimball, from here on after, starts talking about women as jealous and uncontrollable and like these sexual demons if they can't be controlled. So Heber just cracks down because he has been surprised and hurt. Maybe his heart was hurt. and other men too, and they start to get upset. We start to see the rhetoric change with the way that men treat women. So they're having dances, you know, in the Utah period, and you could go and be a married woman and dance with a married man. That was not something bad. But we start to see this sort of being controlled. And while that's happening, this sort of unconstrained thing, this is a Victorian thing, this isn't just a Mormon thing, but it was acceptable, it was more socially acceptable for men to visit houses of ill repute, you know, and keep the women that they were with clean and pure while they, you know, got their man on at the, you know, red light district in Salt Lake City. And so there were these, all of these conflicts going on, and Utah has a, I'm sorry, I'm not a scholar, I just do this publicly, so I don't have to use scholarly terms. So anyway, so I think that there's this conflict. I think the men were doing that, and we're seeing it, we saw it throughout all sorts of weird ways in southern Utah. Then these courting become men coercing women. There's, I mean, John B. Lee tells several stories of, like, if a man raped a woman, then he got to claim her as his own because she's now soiled. I mean, it just acted out in all these weird, crazy ways. So, and Paula Kelly Harleen talks about it as being seen as multiple monogamy. So if you were married, it wasn't like, I would be married to my sister wives too. It would be like, this was one relationship, this is another, and this is another. So when a man was courting a plural wife, he was under a lot of pressure to do it quickly, because it was also seen scandalous for a married man to be, taking a young woman out in his wagon, and nobody knows, like, are they having an affair, or is he courting her? That was also a huge problem, especially in Salt Lake City. So there's all of these weird, weird dynamics, and we see it happening with, like, with the Lost Boys, you know, the ratios. And there are stories during the Mormon Reformation that you couldn't find a wife if you're a man, and men, you know, Southern Utah castration stories, all that kind of stuff. So I don't even know if that answers your question.
Oh, this is news to me.
I don't know if we want to go down that road today. Just in Southern Utah, there are rumors that, Bishop Snow was a famous one. Bishop Snow wanted a young wife to be his 11th wife. She was engaged to a young man, and so they allegedly took the young man and castrated him because he wouldn't give her up. You can look it up. That's a whole other story. But yeah, so there, it just ends up in all these weird, weird ways.
I don't have as much language as you do to keep up, so I'm going to pass.
That's great.
Okay, let's go.
If you're talking about courting today, people such as the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ, the ones, the Crickets, the ones in Colorado City, they do a placement. The priesthood decides who gets what. If you go to some of the others, such as the AUB, they'll entertain that perhaps somebody wants to get married, but it still requires the okay of the one man at a time, whoever that happens to be. If you go to a group such as the what they call themselves, the True and Loving Branch, the Peterson Group, it's very similar. But if you go a little bit further, some of the other groups, you'll find that the girl has the option to decide where she wants to go. And she'll go to her father, and someone will approach the man. I'm talking about into plural marriage. And the man is strictly forbidden to go looking or shopping or to have a revelation, because those revelations put undue pressure on the women. So there's a whole spectrum. It goes the whole distance. You can't say it's one way or the other, because it's not. It depends on what group you're talking about. It depends on who's in charge sometimes, even.
I do want to push, not shy, I just want to say something about it too. So Centennial Park is one of those groups where they say that the women can choose the husbands, which is technically true, but I think we need to keep in mind that it's sort of, I guess Mormons would understand that as a calling. So what can happen is the woman can go to the priest and say, I have brother so-and-so in mind. And so he'll call the family, and he's right, the men have no say in it. But neither do the first wives. So, and this we see in the essays too. We talk about consent, that women could choose their husbands, and that's only half true, because we're talking about women that are marrying plurally could choose their husbands. But these wives don't have a say, and there are many stories of men showing up in wagons with a wife in the wagon, being like, sorry, they told me to, you know, without even asking consent. Now, while there is a spectrum, like you said, because, of course, they are required to ask, it's just not so simple to say, like, hey, everyone has choice, and women get to ask. It's a lot more complicated.
Can I ask a question? Just to...
I'd like to ask a question of you, sir, about the different communities. The legal event that brought a lot of pressure on the FLDS.
Not necessarily.
Well, I mean, where the woman escaped and got to the phone booths.
There are fundamentalist groups that almost don't practice plural marriage.
Well, I'm asking.
In most cases, a lot of the girls have chosen to just marry one man.
But my question is, what about the physical abuse that this one particular woman suffered? She had bruises and she called the police. Is this abnormal? Is this unusual? Are there women trying to escape?
It depends on who's telling the story.
Yeah.
Lindsay had as her guest this week, what's her name?
Irene
Coons, LeBaron Stubbs Spencer.
Yeah.
Nice.
Irene probably believes that stuff. Mm-hmm. Nobody else does that knows her. But I'll just say this. I won't call her a liar. I'll just say that in the road of life, some people see the roses, some people just remember the thorns.
Yeah. So it's unusual to have people trying to escape. That's melodrama.
It depends on the group.
Yeah.
It depends on where you're at. Okay. Some places you'd have to escape. Some places you're not happy to die.
Yeah.
In some groups, everybody understands that you can't hold anybody anytime against the will. It depends on the group. It depends on how tied they are to 132.7.
Yeah.
And there's only one on the earth at a time. You know.
Did you have a comment here?
Yeah. Go ahead.
I think it's very interesting to read some other polygamy narratives, say from North Africa, particularly those that are from the women's point of view, and they are always, it's the same story. It's always tough for the first wife, and thinking all of a sudden your husband's off with somebody the age of your daughter. Mm-hmm. And so I think in all of societies, there's about 2% of the population that practices polygamy. And that is, it's usually practiced in one form or another among those who can't afford it or have the power to do it, but it really doesn't work universally.
I do want to say that, Catherine Daines and Paula Kelly-Hurley in their research, and they scoured through so many women's journals back in the day, and they said the overwhelming theme was, polygamy was hard, it nearly killed me, but I felt it was from God. And so whenever I'm talking about these narratives, even contemporary narratives, that is how I try to frame their experience. It was hard, it nearly killed me, but I believe it was from God. And I think that those three components need to, be weighed in. And even though I don't believe in polygamy, we can't discount that faith component that drives women to do that. So it is a huge Mormon doctrine. We have this too. We're not exempt from it, that sacrifice brings forth the blessings of heaven. And sometimes the harder things are, the more blessed you're going to be. And this is sort of how it's lived out. So
you're right here.
Is there an instance in the Bible where God commanded prophets to practice polygamy, or is that just what they did back then? Because, I mean, they're always saying, we're going to restore this the way it was anciently. Well, was it this way anciently? Did God command?
Well, there were plural families. Yes.
Sure. I mean, you know.
But it's hard to see or hear the God being talking. You know, it's something you see on paper. And,
well, we know the 12 tribes of Israel come from four different women. All of them, I guess, simultaneously, his wife, Jacob's wife. But I just wondered, there's nothing in there where God comes down and says, you've got to do this? And that prophet was all upset about it?
We have a no there. Sir, what do you...
The Levirate wives, in other words, if the man died without having children, his brother, whether he was married or not, was responsible to try to bring up a son. And then the other one, in the case of rape or even consensual sex, the punishment was to get married. And you couldn't get divorced. Now, they didn't say anything about whether the guy had a wife already or not. Mm-hmm. So that's two.
Those are good points. But in terms of the patriarchs you specifically asked about, I'm not aware of any commandment from God. In fact, there's a whole rabbinic tradition that wonders aloud whether Abraham really did the right thing in taking Hagar, you know, taking Sarah's suggestion and taking Hagar to wife, because it ended rather disastrously. Was Abraham just impatient that the promises of God would have been fulfilled anyway if he had simply waited as a question? And also, in DMC 132, you know how it says there's this precedent for polygamy, and it says Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The presence of Isaac in that list is problematic, because Isaac was not a polygamist. And he had a father who was a polygamist, he had a son who was a polygamist, and his wife, Isaac's wife, Rebecca, had fertility problems. And yet, he did not take another wife. And that is a very interesting kind of stubbornly, quietly resistant tradition that's within the biblical witness.
I think a source for that, you know, if one wanted to do research, might be the Sansina Kumash, which is rabbinical writings collected at Sansina, Italy, and it goes back to extensive footnotes. And
it was all about property rights.
Yeah, that would be very interesting to follow up.
Let's see. How about we do two more questions here and then hereafter?
So, as a preference, my Orthodox family who I talk to about polygamy usually would rather not go there. It's something they just don't want to particularly talk about. I think that's fairly common. They know it's there, but they don't want to go there. So I'm interested in what the panel's views are. How will this get brought into the Sunday school manuals, the Relief Society manuals, and how will that discussion take place on a very practical level within the church without causing some real cognitive dissonance among Orthodox members?
I bet they're worrying about that a lot.
I'm sure they are.
To that, Archbishop, so we can respond to both of them. There is no place to talk about this, you know, and I think they need to be talked about among the faithful. And the church, it seems to me, is losing an opportunity to have to provide a forum for the discussion of these things. Mm-hmm. So people are having to go to the internet and that sort of thing. And do you see what I'm saying? In other words, that I think that's a problem.
Because it's still true, right?
There's the question. That's the big question.
And is there a space to repudiate that at church? We say, we know we want to be a church, but we don't believe completely. It's a bad idea.
In other words, should there be a forum, you know, where the church provides?
Relief Society, isn't that a forum?
Yes, I'm going to go to Relief Society and print out these for members of your church.
Well, a lot of people are using them.
So I have heard that it's going to be incorporated into the seminary manuals, which is what prompted Christy Money's op-ed to the Salt Lake Tribune. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but she was concerned about the language used. Can excuse predatory behavior. And it's not like this is like an unfounded thing. There are many stories of particularly LDS men reading church history, reading the language that Joseph used, and have a revelation and say, hey, Elizabeth Smart, you're supposed to be my wife. Or I'm thinking of the Lafferty brothers because we just made it in the news again. This is a common story, right? People take, this is what I'm saying, Mormon theology is a strong potion. People take it and they go there with it. So Christie's op-ed was concerned about the language, the actual language of the essays, and how they're going to affect it, because it does open the door for grooming. I mean, without saying that Joseph Smith was wrong in this way, it was like God asked him to do it, and he didn't want to do it. And it was really hard for everyone, but he did it anyway. Like, predators can take that language and use that language to do whatever they want. So that's a problem. So, should the church have a forum to do it? Yes. Should they do it responsibly? Yes. Is that going to happen? Probably not. And can we repudiate it? Reasonable minds can disagree with me with this. I don't think so. I think our Mormonism is fundamentally tied to polygamy. It's everywhere. It's in our temples, it's in our practices, it's in our culture. It is everywhere. That's my opinion.
What do you really think about all of that? Joseph didn't want to do it. And he didn't do it with Helen Marr
Hold your question until afterward, please. It can be done. We can have these conversations in church. And when I was a convert and didn't know any better, and I was in a ward that was in a very intellectual area in Princeton, New Jersey, okay, granted, that's not typical maybe of the church, but my gospel lecture teacher, who was studying history professionally, brought documents from polygamous ancestors and other people, and we talked about it openly. I just thought that was normal, that was what was going to happen in church. I thought that was great. But, you know, obviously that's not typical. If it's done in the right way, absolutely, people will be open to having those conversations if it is done in a tactful and pastoral way, I think.
Okay, your question.
I was just going to make a quick comment about the way these narratives are told, and I've been... Lindsay brought it up just about how everything is such from a male perspective. Like, any rhetoric we've ever heard about polygamy is from a male perspective, because there's the ones writing the talks and there's the ones. And I think that there's just so many women that are so pained by it, but they think they don't have a choice. And then what I've noticed with a lot of people having faith transitions is the men will find out about the polyandry and they'll be like, oh my gosh, I'm bleeding. But the women have been dealing with that since they were like 12, that they would have to share. And then the thing I'm hearing sometimes now is like, yeah, it's not fair. Those first wives, but they're not thinking about the second wife. So there's just all these layers of like people that are a little bit more oppressed. You know what I mean? So I just thought that was a really important point. Just the way that it affects everybody all the way through.
It does, and I think you're right that we often we do look at it through our own lens. I mean, George, no offense to you, but what you said was that it's terrible to think about, you know, these women who are already married being married to a polygamous man. Well, that's a male perspective, and then you said, what about the first wife and her perspective? You know, that's a very female perspective. I'm totally with you on that. And if you read some of the anti-polygamy fiction in the 19th century, it was written by these Protestant women, it's always that the first wife is this long-suffering slave and the second wife is some tramp that comes with their home and just ruins everything. So we're always going to see it from our own eyes, and we have to be aware that most of the literature here is from a male perspective.
Okay, I'd just like to thank you all for attending since then, and we have about an hour and a half for lunch. Okay.